The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Imagine your home totally organized with Closets by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN.
Hello and welcome to a brand new best podcast in baseball where I get to talk to writer, longtime baseball writer, the national writer, well-respected writer for New York Times, Bleacher Report, a lot of different places. And now he's got a new book out called Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and They Always Will. We'll talk about how managers were marginalized by Hollywood, superseded by baseball ops, but perhaps in the modern game are more important than advertised and maybe more important than ever. It's my conversation with Scott Miller. Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by widely respected, highly regarded, longtime baseball writer Scott Miller, whose work you've read with the New York Times, Bleacher Report, a lot of different places. And now, Scott, author. Author again, but author here with your new book, Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and They Always Will. Scott, it's great to talk to you. It's good to see you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Nice to be with you, Derek. Thanks for having me. And very always nice talking baseball with you, whether it's in a press box, podcast, whatever.
It's fitting that we talk this week because, you know, your book is about managing and managing in the modern game. And we do so just a few hours, it feels like, after three managers have been fired. Is that striking to you, Scott, that we're not even at Memorial Day and we have three managers, each of whom was respected a lot? I know just from the NL Central point of view, how much his peers respected Shelton's managing, strategic managing of a game and what he was given there. Does it surprise you, and is it oversimplifying to say all three of them just took the heat for missteps from the front office?
You know,
was I too blunt there? Sorry.
No. I think you're right. I think for sure, in the case of Derek Shelton and Brandon Hyde in Baltimore, they took the heat for the front office. I think
and the ownership, and in Pittsburgh, the ownership.
And ownership, and really in Bud Black too. I do think. I mean, I don't want to all of a sudden become a guy like, hey, I wrote a book of managers. I'm going to stick up for them nonstop. And all three firings this year are the fault of the ownership and front office. But I do think that you can make a case. I mean, you know, in Colorado, that's been going south for a number of years. There doesn't seem to be any plan. I mean, you know, they sent Troy Tulowitzki to a long-term deal. That got ugly. They traded him. You know, they had Nolan Arenado was going to be their guy. And then that didn't go well. You know, they signed Chris Bryant a couple years ago. It's like, what are you doing? You're not ready to win. Where does he fit?
Yeah. So why didn't you keep Nolan Arenado for less?
Exactly. Right. I mean, there's been no plan in Colorado. So from that perspective, you know, I feel really badly for Buddy Black.
Yeah.
Baltimore, you know what this young Orioles core reminds me a little bit of, and I see a little parallel, Derek, is, you know, the Cubs, when they had their core coming up of Rizzo and Chris Bryant and Baez and Addison Russell. Mm-hmm. But before they won in 2016, what happened? Theo Epstein, they signed John Lester as a free agent. Yeah. They brought in David Ross and they brought in Jason Hayward. Three incredible veteran presence guys who really helped. And that young core of the Cubs, you know, they had some leadership, and that did not happen in Baltimore. And I worry that the core of young talent they have in Baltimore is going to end up being wasted because, again, I don't think the front office, you know, if you had brought in a John Lester and, you know, a few guys like that, I think it'd be a different story in Baltimore right now. So I do blame the front office there. And then Pittsburgh's been the same old story for about the last 20 years. So that there's that.
But, and they're about to waste a young core of great pitching.
Yeah, Skeens. And I remember when Brian Reynolds was going to maybe resign, and he said, I love this place, I want to resign, but they were lowballing him. And then that was a thing. And then finally he resigned, and it was like, okay, you know, a new age in Pittsburgh. And it never seems to be. But I think it's noteworthy all these three guys have been fired simply because you don't see firings as often anymore, I don't think. I don't have stats to back that up, but.
No, you don't. No, you're right. You're right. It's not hockey anymore. Yeah, hockey is the one.
Right. And I think it's because all these managers collaborate with the front office.
Right. They get protection. Yeah. Yeah.
And they get the benefit of the doubt, and they get, it's not all about just, are you winning or losing? There are other things involved. And when a front office has a manager they like to work with, you know, you don't see the firings as often anymore. So I think this has definitely been a noteworthy year in terms of three firings already.
So true. You know, the idea of being, you know, the forward face of the franchise comes with job security because you're willing to take the fire. So your contract is asbestos, you know, congrats, you know, you get to see it out. Yeah. Yeah. That's so fascinating. What was the genesis of this project for you? Why did you set out to write a book on the modern day manager?
You know, it's funny. I guess it's a lesson that sometimes maybe some of the best ideas are some of the most simple ideas that are right in front of you. And I say that because, you know, back in 2018, I co-authored the book 90% Mental with Bob Tewksbury, the former Cardinals all-star pitcher and turned mental skills coach. And it was about mental skills in baseball. And, you know, I had fun with that. Anyway, that came out 2018. So over the next couple of years, I learned in the book business or something similar, what the title, the next project, the phrase, the next project, I learned up close what that means, because my literary agent and I would talk every now and then, and we'd talk about, well, what do you want the next project to be? And he threw a couple ideas at me, and I wasn't that crazy about them. And then I threw a couple ideas at him. He was like, well, I don't know if that'll sell to a publisher. I don't know if it would sell to the public. You know, it might be too whatever, esoteric, too niche, whatever. And so we kicked some ideas around for a couple of years. But it turns out this idea, the genesis to your question, when I say sometimes the best ideas are maybe sitting right in front of your nose, I realized one day, I can't remember exactly the day or time or anything, but a couple of years back, you know, what have we all been talking about in the baseball world for about 10 years now is, where do lineups come from? Mm. You know, do these managers today, they've been reduced to middle managers. You know, man, this job has changed. Nothing like it used to be. And we've all had so many conversations like that. And I realized one day, you know, there's certainly been no books written on the subject, let alone, I don't know if there've been any long takeouts anywhere. And, you know, people have touched on the subject, but I thought, I've been covering baseball long enough, and, you know, I have at least a couple names in my contact list that I can call and meet with in person. And I ended up talking to about 200 people, probably. Wow. Players, ex-players, managers, ex-managers, executives, ex-executives. And when we finally hit on the idea, it was, man, I should have thought of this a couple years earlier than I did.
I mean, for the sake of full disclosure, your contacts took you to Dusty Baker's vineyard to talk with him about managing, into Jim Tracy's living room to talk with him. You had time with Terry Francona, Tito Francona, and then, of course, watched Aaron Boone's game with his dad. Is that correct? You were there kind of enjoying the Yankees game and watching Aaron Boone manage while his father watched?
Yeah, that was fun. I you know, I always try to take readers into areas that, you know, you can't get to, because Derek, as you know, you and I have a license to get to places a lot of people can't. And so, yeah, what happened is I with the Boones is I had I knew I was going to do a chapter on the Boones and the Bells.
Right. David, who had the tie to the Cardinals.
Right. And, you know, the legacies, you know, their dads played, their grandfathers played. And in and both of their fathers managed. And so I thought, well, you know, it'd be interesting to talk to like Bob Boone about, you know, when he managed Cincinnati and in Kansas City back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, and Bob, what was your manage? What was it like then? What did you do? You know, when you watch Aaron manage, what do you see now? How different is it from when you managed? Yeah, you know, I had a lot of questions like that I wanted to talk to him about, but I thought, that'd be really cool if I could. And I, after I talked to Aaron, you know, I talked to obviously the Yankees people, Aaron and Brian Cashman, all those people. But when I talked to Aaron, you know, I told him my idea. I said, I'd really like to, if I can do it, if your mom and dad would be amenable, I'd like to go sit down with them and interview your dad, which I want to do anyway. Maybe with one of your games on TV in the background, we watch a Yankees game and watch you manage. And Aaron signed off on it. He was cool about it. And yeah, so I spent one night over at the Boone's house, Sue and Bob, you know, watching Aaron manage and interviewing Bob about his career, about Aaron's career. And then when the game was over, came the press conferences. You know, they're all on television now. So
yeah, yeah.
Sue was in and out of the room, but both mom and dad came in for the press conferences. It was a lot of fun watching the press grill Aaron while I was standing there watching with mom and dad.
That's a whole new aspect of managing. In the book you write about, you know, I think in talking with Theo Epstein, you mentioned how all the games are accessible now. Yeah. Less so maybe this year than in previous years because of the RSN collapse. But anyway, for the most part, every game, every team can get every game. A lot of fans can get every game, or at least detailed stats from all of them. But that also includes the press conferences and everything. And I find it interesting that we're in this age where managers talk to the press multiple times a day. Multiple times within that day, they'll have one-on-ones, they'll have everything like that. They are very much the forward face of every franchise, and yet they aren't often the face of the franchise because we're in such a general manager slash baseball ops driven time. Sure. I think that creates such a fascinating dynamic where, and I've spoken to this, there are times where I've gone into visiting teams, press conferences or thing like that, and I've felt awkward asking the manager about a decision that I know the front office made, not him.
Yes.
And I it's such an interesting time where the team has hired somebody to be the forward face of it. And yet more than ever, this game is about GMs. Is that something you ran into a lot? And how did you kind of parse that as you talk to modern managers about their approach to the game, knowing so much of it is shaped by the GM?
Right. Yeah. And I talked with Aaron Boone, Dave Roberts, many people about that. And, you know, it's just the way it is today. And there are a couple of different things I think here. You know, one, obviously the managers today just accept that as part of the gig. Rather than fight back like maybe an Earl Weaver would have, because, you know, it's the old story. There are only 30 of these jobs that exist in the world.
Yeah.
So if you want one of these jobs, you're going to have to take both the good and the bad with it. And the bad might be if it's an overbearing analytics department or whatever. But if you want a chance, you're going to have to just roll with it and try and see if it works for you. And, you know, I did ask Aaron, it's funny because I think things are oversimplified today in terms of the simple question, where do the lineups come from? Right. A lot of fans, a lot of people say like, oh, analytics, certain teams, they just hand the lineup to the manager. And then that's it. Like it's that simple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that to me, Derek, the where do lineups come from? That's the baseball version of the conversation when little kids ask their parents, "Mom, Dad, where do babies come from?" It's a total awkward conversation.
Right.
Nobody wants to have it. Your feet shuffle, the eyes look up into the sky, you don't make eye contact. And, you know, that's kind of how it is with where do lineups come from. And I did. You know, within interviewing Aaron Boone and Dave Roberts, just to name two, you know, I asked them flat out. I said, you know, what about people that think, you know, you just get handed the lineups? And obviously both Aaron and Dave said that doesn't happen. We hear it and it's amusing, but it doesn't happen. Now, it's tough to ask because each manager, obviously these are prideful men.
Yeah.
They're not going to admit, oh, I just get the daily lineup handed to me at 3:00. But on the other hand, everybody knows that it's, as Dave Roberts, he uses the word collaborative. It's a collaborative process today.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think that's probably the greatest oversimplification is that some of these managers are just like on marionette strings and the front office is doing whatever. I mean, there are certain decisions and certain things that front offices obviously implement or want to implement be it in a specific game like tonight's game or over the course of the next seven or eight games. You know, there's stuff that comes up. But generally, the collaboration comes in, you know, there are one, two, three, usually multiple meetings a day. Mm-hmm. In the afternoon between, you know, somebody, I don't want to say it's not like, that's the other thing. I think people have this idea. There are big formal meetings, like the entire analytics department meets with the manager at whatever, 2 o'clock. Well, it's not the entire, but there's one, two, three people from analytics maybe come into the manager's office and they talk about tonight's game and the lineup and
yeah,
and what kind of shape the starting pitcher's in. And through the conversation is where a lot of the decisions are made. And you know, manager, you know, might not be told what to do, but when, you know, you get into tonight's game in the fifth or sixth inning, you have a pretty good idea if the game goes down Avenue A, down Avenue B, down Avenue C, in terms of how well the starting pitcher's doing, when you need relievers called in. They've talked about all these different scenarios. Then the manager has all that background in his head when he makes the decision.
I think of putting together a coaching staff, just like putting together a roster. You have to find ways to create a chemistry and a mix that works and know that some folks are going to have to accept a role that they may aspire to be greater than. You might have a bench job or a utility job in a dugout and on a roster, just like a coach may be an assistant and aspire to be the hitting coach and aspire to have more say in the at bats, the same way the young player aspires to have more at bats. And I think it's really fascinating. Your book charts this, kind of maps the notion of the introduction / invasion / integration of analytics into the clubhouse with the Rockies moving an executive into the front office. I believe the Angels did as well. There are some other teams that did. I've watched firsthand as the Cardinals did this. Mike Schilt brought in a liaison for the analytics, someone he could trust. That was something that was very important, was like, who do I have chemistry with?
Yep.
And can speak the lingo and be a liaison too. And then last year where the Cardinals didn't have the staff size to do it. So all of a sudden the pitching coach was taking on the jobs of three or four different people and trying to speak all those different languages. It was asking a computer to multitask beyond what they could. And then this year they've added staff where it is more specific. Are you seeing that same kind of thing develop? Like the way a clubhouse talks about chemistry, does that also have to exist between the manager's office, the analytics, and the front office, the upstairs, downstairs, as you describe it?
Yeah, no doubt, because I think in today's game, relationships and trust are as important or maybe more important than ever.
Great point.
You know, because the players, and that's why you see the nice guy managers being hired instead of the old hard asses. You know, Sparky Anderson did not want to get to know his players very much. And part of his thinking was, look, if I get to know my players personally, there's going to come a day I'm going to trade them, I'm going to release them, and it's going to really hurt. And I talked to Dan Petrie, who was a part of the 1984 Tigers World Series rotation. Mm-hmm. And Petrie said, man, when we were young, especially, we were scared to death of Sparky. And I told the coaches, like, look, I don't want to go near his office. The only time you got called in his office was if you were getting sent down or if you had screwed something up in the game and he needed to chew you out. He said, other than that, you never went Sparky's office. He never called you in just say, hey, good job. Whereas today, the relationships, just the nature of, you know, over time, generations have changed. And now, obviously, players are different than they used to be. Today's players, you know, play travel ball. And they're used to specialized coaching and they want answers. They want to know why. And so back to the relationships and to the trust, so many of the modern managers, Dave Roberts is a master at it and many, many others. You've got to first have trust, you know, earn the trust of your players, because if you don't, you're not going to last long as a manager. And that's been true forever.
Mm-hmm.
But more so now than ever, because if they look at the manager just as a vessel for the front office and they don't think the manager is his own guy, then trust is gone immediately and things are going to go south. So the manager has to thread that needle. Really, it's a really tricky needle to thread because he has to develop the trust of his players, as I say, and they to where they don't view him as just a puppet. He has to develop and trust that goes both ways with the analytics people. You know, not only does he have to trust them, but he has to earn their trust. And that's why it's in a weird way, you know, I mean, like the job, you know, Ali Marmol is doing today. You look at the lineage of Cardinal managers and, you know, whatever it is, Red Schoendies, Whitey Herzog, all the way through. And on paper, it all looks the same. But the job Marmol is doing today as a manager is completely different than, you know, Whitey Herzog or Red Schoendies or anybody else did, just because it's changed so much.
Yeah.
It, strategy, for example, I talked about trust in relationships. The weird thing is, you know, managers used to be hired a lot for their strategic acumen, right?
I mean, yeah,
you know, you wanted a guy that could outfox the guy in the other dugout. Whereas today, it's almost like all strategies the same because analytics has kind of run bunting and hit and running and all that stuff out of the game. And everybody agrees we don't want to give up any extra outs. So it's almost today managers are hired it for different reasons. It's not, well, we think this guy's an unbelievable tactician. It's relationships. He can carry things out and, you know, our plan out, and he can relate to the players.
Yeah, I find that you're exactly right. And, you know, I watched the blend of that to me was what I watched in Milwaukee with Craig Counsell, where there was a clear strategy developed by analytics in the front office for how they were going to use their bullpen, what makeup they wanted in the bullpen, what style of pitching, and then how it would be deployed. And one of the best things that I've seen a manager do is Craig's ability to get buy-in from those pitchers for those roles. That's almost like what they, you know, that's almost like why the front office hired. It's not the only reason, but like that was Craig's gift, was like, all right, we are hiring you to galvanize a clubhouse, galvanize a bullpen around roles that they may not entirely want. We need you to sell Devin Williams on not being the closer, Hader on not being the closer, but still pitching the most valuable inning and not getting the stat that will then give him more money in arbitration. That's the manager's job. And I was really impressed year after year after year with the buy-in that he got from those relievers who trusted, like, well, I'll excel in this and we'll win and eventually my riches will come later. Whereas, you know, I saw Mike Matheny struggle with it because, you know, he wanted to get the guy who was his best reliever the saves because he knew what that could mean for his career, for his financial status. You know, and I appreciated like that struggle. I appreciated Matheny's honesty about that struggle. And I think that was a really interesting thing because it showed two ways to go about the same thing, which was gaining the trust of the players and how each guy had to manage that differently.
No doubt. Yeah. And those are two great examples. And I would throw Kevin Cash in Tampa Bay in there as well. Here's
exactly
a guy, when Tampa Bay invented the opener. And so Kevin Cash had to go around to his starters and say, look, you're a starter, but we're going to do things a little differently. You're going to start the second inning. We're going to have a reliever pitch the first inning. And that was like, you know, speaking a foreign language to some of these guys. I mean, you know, if you've been a starter your entire life, you're used to the routine, your pride's on the line. It's part of your self-identity. And now all of a sudden, wait a minute, I'm a starter, but you're telling me I have to watch the first inning and then I start the second inning. And same thing, you great examples with Counsell and Matheny. And Cash, I think, also is a genius in Tampa Bay at getting that buy-in from players. Hey, we're going to do things differently here, and we have to do things differently here. And this is what we're going to, you know, one way we're going to do it. And it's amazing. Like I say, just the managing job used to be so much about strategy, and now it's about, yes, relationships, getting buy-in from players, selling, basically selling some of the front offices, the analytics ideas, analytical ideas to the players, sell them, and then get buy-in from them on it.
And covering for them publicly, you know, exactly. with the questions from the media. Yeah. So fascinating. It's like spokesman as much as strategist.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. In fact, I think Dave Roberts had he has a comment in the book somewhere along the line that it's like, you know, hey, the White House, I'm trying to remember exactly how he said it, but it was either chief of staff of the White House. It might've been chief of staff rather than.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he gets all the information and then, you know, he talks and that's kind of what it is. It's almost, you know, like being the communications person in a totally different way for the White House, where you get all this information and then you're the one that's out there on the island that's got to disseminate it to the public.
One of the things in your book that I appreciate, like just the thread that it draws through the history of managers, going back to Connie Mack and his suit and the luxury he had of also owning the team. But also then like charting the kind of the signature or the emblematic managers of eras. That's what I kind of got from reading it. I was like, oh, you know, like there's a whole generation that sees managing as Earl Weaver. There's a whole generation that sees managing maybe as the volatility of Billy Martin. There's definitely a whole generation that goes Sparky Anderson is what a baseball manager is here in St. Louis. It's that a manager is what Whitey Herzog is. For me, it's Tony La Russa on the cover of video games and sort of the cerebral manager, right?
Yes.
Like I remember him, you know, the men at work, all that stuff. You know, I mean, he was everywhere. He was the lawyer. He was the scholastic manager.
Yes.
And then you have Art Howe's representation in Moneyball. And I wanted to ask you that, like, one, first of all, who's the emblematic manager of your times? Like, who's the one that like you go, oh, well, that's what a manager, well, like you first recognize and resonated with, oh, that's a manager. And who is it now for kids? Who is it now for young baseball fans?
You know, I'd probably go, for me, I'm a Michigan kid. I grew up in Michigan.
Okay.
30 minutes south of Detroit. So I grew up a Tigers fan. So, you know, probably I'd go right to Sparky Anderson. And I'll tell you, you know, one instructive thing from writing the book, you know, it's funny, you know, just as you learn and mature over the years, before Sparky, you know, I was about 10 years old or whatever when the Tigers employed Billy Martin. Mm-hmm. And I loved Billy Martin back then. And he had decent success. He wasn't there very long because, as we know, he wore out his welcome pretty quickly everywhere. But anyway, as a kid, I was like, that's ridiculous. The Tigers fired Billy Martin. You've got to be kidding me. They've been doing pretty well. And now all these years later, you know, I knew some of it, but then researching the book, I mean, you know, the Tigers are in Oakland and they fly back home for the start of a homestand. And Billy's not on the team playing. He flies to like Kansas City to go visit a girlfriend on the way home while he's married. And then he's half an hour late to batting practice the next day. And there are too many of those instances. So now it's like from that mature author phase, look at it, I'm like, okay. That's why he didn't last long in Detroit. And my little kid idea of that was a little off. Mm-hmm. But Sparky was the guy, you know, for me growing up in my formative baseball years. You know, it was so fun watching him. He was so colorful. And of course, you know, he channeled Casey Stengel in his language. And,
sure.
So, you know, I'd probably go right to him, but beyond, today, it's really hard to come up with a manager who's like that archetype. I mean, probably Bruce Bochy, now that Bochy came back, and Terry Francona came back out of retirement in Cincinnati, you know, I'd go those two. You know, probably Dave Roberts is working his way in, especially with the World Series win last year.
Sure.
You know, and that's why I spent time with him for the one chapter of the book. You know, I shadowed him for 4 or 5 days because I wanted to kind of show readers what is life like day to day, you know, for a kind of a quintessential modern manager. And that's where we settled on Dave Roberts for that reason.
Yeah. I wonder if you were to go and say to a young fan, do you aspire to be a general manager? Can you name general managers? How many they would rattle off? Whereas if you go, do you want to be a manager? How many they would rattle off? I don't know if we're quite there yet. I think the uniform still probably resonates, but I do know that, like, I do remember like a shift even in my time covering baseball where the emails went from, can you believe the manager did this, to now they are predominantly, can you believe the baseball operations does this? I mean, the manager still takes criticism for pitching changes and hindsight stuff, but the young aspiring baseball people who want jobs in baseball, they want to run the roster, not run games, which is a little different.
It totally different. No, you're right. And again, just the generations change.
Yeah, it's I wonder if it goes from like from playing tabletop baseball to playing fantasy baseball. It's that different, right? It's like you would play the tabletop baseball games and Stratomatic, and you'd manage games. Yep. And now you're playing fantasy baseball and you want to create rosters. I wonder if that's what's happening as well.
Yeah, it might be a little comparison there, I think, no doubt. And, you know, in our business, I see from a lot of young writers, it's, you know, Twitter became such a big thing. Sure. And a lot of people began to think, well, the key to being a baseball writer is to just keep trying to break news on Twitter in one or two sentences, you know, and things just change. You know, I always wanted to be more of a storyteller. And beyond that, I wanted, you know, I mean, look, obviously numbers are hugely important in baseball. We all know them, but you know, you can kind of come at it from the analytics side where you scour the computer and run the numbers, or from the other side, you know, I come at it from that side, the more human side, I think, where, you know, I'm more interested in the personalities and the stories and, you know, the human side of baseball, which gets back to this managing book, you know, because I just became very interested in this topic as you know, as I started to put the book together about, you know, all the numbers, this numbers, that analytics, this analytics, that, but you know, the manager is kind of getting shortchanged here. Mm-hmm. And they're more important than people think they are still, I would argue.
Yeah, I know that drove Tony La Russa a lot in the wake of Moneyball 2, was seeking out like that kind of story. Scott, do you think at all that the National League Central, this moment in time right now, is a window at all into where managing is headed? Almost like that it's a bit of a snapshot, because you have the youngest manager in the game with the Cardinals. You have a former college coach who was promoted from bench coach to managing the Brewers. You have the highest paid, or the guy who kind of broke the seal for free agency for managers, in Council with the Cubs. You have Tito Francona coming out of retirement for the Reds. And then you have a manager fired with the Pirates. I mean, that's the spectrum, right? Right there, right in the NL Central.
That's right. Yeah, that I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, you're exactly right. It's like all shapes, sizes, and colors, all in this one division, no doubt about it. And it is. And you know, Francona, it's interesting that, you know, Francona, I think Dusty Baker looks like he's done now. Mm-hmm. But you know, the past couple of years, it's been very interesting that it's been guys like Francona and Dusty and Bruce Bochy's come back, and even when Brian Snicker led the Atlanta Braves to a World Series.
Yeah. You know,
in October, we've seen lately, more often than not, kind of those old school type managers still having great success.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting because obviously Cincinnati will probably be Terry Francona's last job, given that he's almost 70 or about to turn 70. And, you know, where Dusty's probably done. Bochy, when he's done in Texas, probably that's it. So we still got a handful of these legends, mm-hmm. but it's kind of the last gasp of those guys, I think. And then it'll totally be a new generation. And some of what we're seeing in the National League Central is, definitely on deck to take over.
What was your conversation like with Mike Matheny? Because he was really at the forefront. He and the great Robin Ventura were right there at the leading edge of a shift in managers that has kind of gone a couple different ways in the years since. One, there was the huge rush to duplicate what the White Sox and specifically what the Cardinals did because of the success the Cardinals had. And then there was like almost a backlash with more hiring of veteran managers or lifelong, or, you know, the guys who worked their way up through the minors. What was your conversation like with Mike as he looked back on his introduction as manager and where things stood now?
Yeah. And I've always liked Mike, and yeah, we had a good conversation. He, you know, he was a little surprised or a lot surprised when John Mozeliak called initially to say, I want to interview you. You know, I have this story in the book where Matheny, he was on set for ESPN in November after what, you know, right around November, doing a some postseason award show or whatever. And
the Gold Glove Award. Yeah. Yeah.
Gold Glove Award. Thank you. And yeah, Mike said I had my phone in my back pocket.
Yeah.
Said, thankfully, I had it on silent because it started buzzing in my back pocket. And when we went to commercial, I looked, see, his, you know, Mo. And when the show was over, I called him and said, I need you in St. Louis tomorrow to interview. And it kind of blindsided Matheny. He was like, what? And but obviously, you know, if you're in a position like Matheny where, you know, you've been in baseball your whole life, you've played. Somebody says, I want to talk to you about managing. You know, you're not going to say, well, wait a minute, I've never done that or I'm not ready. So, you know, obviously he interviewed, it went from there. And, you know, he said, you know, he had a lot to learn. And I think from the Cardinals perspective, after Tony La Russa, they knew they weren't going to get the next Tony La Russa. They wanted somebody completely fresh, you know. And then the conversation with Mike, both managing St. Louis, and then he gets let go, and then he goes to Kansas City. I think he really enjoyed his time as a manager. Looking back, I think he saw how much he had to learn, that he wasn't quite ready. And, you know, and it was interesting because, as you say, with Ventura and Matheny, there were kind of two pivot points in the last 20-some years for managing. One was when Moneyball came out about 2003. That really brought in the analytics movement. That changed the job manager. And then 2012, Cardinals hired Matheny. White Sox hired Robin Ventura. And that was the beginning of the hiring of managers that had never managed before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said, Matheny had some great success early in St. Louis. So, you know, certainly it allowed other clubs to hire managers who had never managed with great confidence, thinking, well, look at the success Matheny's having. And Robin Ventura's first year in Chicago was pretty good. But, you know, looking back, you know, he made a kind of a sardonic comment too about, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm one of those guys to blame for, you know, managers now that have never managed, and people think it's so easy and you can just hire anybody.
Yeah. I mean, that's not true though. Right. Like, right. I know he was kind of like cracking wise about it, but right. I don't think he would agree with that.
Right.
Because you need some sort of, well, maybe that's a good question for you. As you saw through this, was there, and worked through this and talked with folks, were there some like kind of bedrock traits? Obviously minor league experience isn't one. Guys have excelled without that. I think we would both agree that playing in the big leagues isn't one, because we've seen Mike Schilt, who didn't even play professionally, succeed. He's got Manager of the Year award votes every year and deserved them. So are there some bedrock traits you kind of started piecing together that managers all have?
Yeah, at least modern managers. And it goes back to what we were talking about a little while ago about communication,
mm-hmm.
relationship building. You know, when, you know, I mean, in Mike Matheny's case, by the way, you know, he had coached a little bit with La Russa. And he was a catcher. And obviously we know all kinds of catchers that have moved on to become managers. So, you know, he had never managed, but he also had experience at running a game, at least from behind the plate as a catcher. But in terms of the bedrock things that are needed now, you know, again, communication and relationship building, because that's all the managers from about 2012 on that were hired to that had never managed before. You know, guys like Paul Molitor in Minnesota, Aaron Boone with the Yankees. They all are fairly recently retired. They're young enough that they still relate to today's players. And today's players, more importantly, relate to them.
Great point.
And also, they communicate, they're personable. And that's as I say, it's almost that's the stuff that's more important now than, you know, what's a guy going to do strategically?
Right.
Is that.
Yeah. Oh, and Rocco Baldelli is an example of that.
Rocco Baldelli, another great example. Yeah. You can go on. And it's the recently retired guys.
Yeah.
Kind of that very interesting. And the other thing Craig Counsell said when we were talking about money, and as we know, he set the bar for managers when he became a free agent manager and signed with the Cubs. But the other thing he said, we've also hit a point in the game where if you want like an ex-player to manage, these guys now have all made so much money. Like Craig Counsell said, he said, look, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm not trying to be arrogant, but Aaron Boone made whatever he made, you know, $18, $20, $25 million playing baseball. If you want Aaron Boone to manage, or you think he's going to be a good manager, you're not going to go have him manage AAA for 2 years. That's not a job he's going to do. And so that's the other thing with some of the recently retired players who have been hired to manage. It's true. I mean, they can go have a nice life hanging around the game, you know, broadcasting somewhere. You know, why does anybody at this stage who've made $20, $30 million in the game want to go down and you know, it used to be managers, Earl Weaver, Jim Leland, all these guys managed in the minor leagues. Kind of like players. You cut your teeth in the minor leagues and then you got promoted to the big leagues, but that's not the way it works anymore.
I'm so glad you brought that up. You read my mind. I had your book here turn to that page with Counsell's quote about how much money the modern player makes and doesn't need the time on the bus because there's just alternatives. I had jotted in the margin there Ryan Sandberg because remember he went and did that, which I always thought was very impressive. And then he interviewed for the Cardinals opening that Matheny got. But I wanted to bring that quote up in the context of the names that are taught or the players that are tossing their names into the manager conversation right now. Two very famous, very great, very well-known Cardinals, Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols, have openly said they want to manage in the majors. They've stumped for it. They are working their way through international routes to the role. And Matt Holliday is another guy who has expressed interest in managing. And, you know, the question for him has been like, is being a bench coach or a hitting coach as appealing with the hours that it takes and the salary that it gets as being a manager when he could just be with his sons and working for the Boris Corp as kind of a hitting advisor? I wonder what your view is of where do the dugouts go and meet Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols? And what do you make of them being so forthright with their wishes? Mark DeRosa's another player going through the internet, another former player going through the TV and international route who will get consideration for manager. What do you make of that next kind of turn of the managerial wheel?
Yeah. I mean, and I don't blame Yadi or Pujols or anybody for publicly saying I'd like to manage because, you know, I mean, in their shoes, you look at Aaron Boone, you look at, you know, whoever it is, and you know, Rocco Baldelli, it's like these guys made the jump right to manager. So, you know, why can't I? This is what I want to do, so I'm going to let it be known publicly. Obviously, we go back to what we talked about, Derek, earlier in the conversation.
Yeah.
There are only 30 of these jobs. So even if you've got the cachet of Albert Pujols, it's really hard to find that right fit, and it's going to have to be someplace you're comfortable in, and it's going to have someplace where the organization is comfortable with you and thinks we can work with you and collaborate with you, and, you know, and there won't be any issues. Again, going back to trust, you know, Brett Boone told me when we were talking about Aaron Boone, he said, Remember after that walk-off home run in the famous Pedro Martinez game, Aaron Boone hit the walk-off homer.
Yeah.
In game seven. And then that winter, remember, Aaron Boone ripped up his knee playing basketball.
Yeah.
And he went into Brian Cashman and he told him the truth. He didn't try to lie. And it cost him, you know, it cost him more than $3 million because it voided that last year of his contract. And that's what put the whole wheels in motion for the Yankees trade for Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah.
But anyway, Brett said, you know what? If Aaron hadn't gone in, this also goes back to trust and relationships and honesty. Brett said, if Aaron hadn't gone back to Cash and been honest with him about that knee, if he had tried to come up with some excuse like, oh, I ripped up my knee, you know, whatever. I slipped on the ice. Mm-hmm. The truth would have come out. He said, I guarantee you, but for being honest, Aaron probably wouldn't have been hired by the Yankees. And when I talked to Brian Cashman, I mentioned it because I talked to Brett first. I said, Brett told me this. You know, what do you think? And Cashman said, absolutely, I agree. He said, Aaron being honest in that moment, really, even though it was several years ago, I had that in the back of my mind because in this job, general manager, president of baseball operations, whatever it is, and manager, you've got to trust each other because over 6 months, things are going to go wrong. And if I am afraid my manager is going to go rogue and say this publicly or that publicly and make us look bad, I can't work with him. And I knew with Aaron, because of that knee and the way he handled that, I knew, you know, this is a guy I can trust and I can get into a foxhole with. And so anyway, back to Pujols and Yachty, that's the kind of thing that also has to happen. I mean, maybe not to that extreme, but a team is going to have to say, hey, I can really trust this guy and work with this guy. And same for Albert and Yachty. They're going to have to feel that way about the team.
I think that one of the things that stands out to me is to merge that council quote where, like, all the money that they've made and, you know, the wish to not kind of go through the system again in the minors to be a manager. I do think that it speaks a lot to what Albert Pujols wants to accomplish and become a manager that he went to the Dominican Winter League, that he's taking on the Dominican Republic. And I know that just reading between the lines and talking to him a little bit, that like that is his way of saying, I am not entitled to you crowning me manager because I have 700 home runs. It's very much like he's in, I talked with him at the World Series there out in Arizona a couple of years ago. And he was talking to me about the steps that he wanted to put together to learn the greater scope of the game, front office, broadcast, how teams are owned and purchased. And he was like, I want to accumulate this knowledge so that I'm better when I seek out a specific role, which now is manager. And I think that's a really interesting way to build trust is to say, I'm willing to do these things and not just wait for you to crown me manager.
No doubt. I mean, everything you just said, I think is brilliant on Pujols' part from managing the Dominican Winter League to wanting to learn of every aspect of the operation. Cause that is only, if he does get his chance one day, that's only going to make him better as a manager, make him better as a front man for the organization or a key foundation piece for the organization. And I think, you know, it's going to also help him just understand better the way things work and the way the world around him is going. And I think, with that attitude like that, I really like his chances to manage.
Scott, there are so many really good lines in your book here that I really enjoyed from a writer's perspective. You brought up one, I thought just the subtlety of calling the lineup shorthand for all the questions that managers face. I thought that was brilliant. You're so right that the lineup slipped under the door has become this euphemism for the greater questions about how much influence and how much power a manager has. And I just like the way you describe that. There is a quote in your book. Again, it's called Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and Always Will. There is a quote, though, that I got to be honest, like I had to read multiple times because it just so, I think, gave me somewhat like an aha chill moment, if that makes sense. Like just as a fan of the game. And I wanted to get your thoughts on it because you were there when it was delivered. And I want to kind of know what you think it means for the coming years of managing in the majors. It's from Sandy Alderson. And he says, he's talking about the fallout from Moneyball and the two decades since. And he said, and we've ended up with a very homogenous group of managers. That is such a short and in some ways damning sentence. What do you think that says? And is that good?
I don't think it's good because I think you want variety. And I don't think anything, anytime things get too homogenous, I think it gets bland, boring, and probably not the best way you could go about things. But yeah, I mean, he was talking about, you know, what we've got now, and this is kind of since Moneyball, is, you know, and he explained it very well too, the way Moneyball came into the game. Mm-hmm. You know, teams used to, you know, generations ago, some teams were family owned, and then you, in modern day, it's more corporate owned. You have a few families, but it's a lot of it is corporate. And he said, you know, Moneyball came out, all of the owners read that, and it made sense to them because they were like, instead of holding a franchise as a trophy asset, they were like, wait a minute, this could be run like the other 20 businesses I have and maybe make some money here. Mm-hmm. And so he said, so then the owners go hire either a president of baseball operations or a general manager. That's kind of an extension of their same philosophy, of the owner's philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then the GMs hire a manager that's the extension of that entire philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so when you've got all 30 teams looking at things in a similar way, that's how you end up with a group of homogenous managers. And I mean, I think certainly for the entertainment value of the game, it's definitely sucked some soul out of the game. Mm-hmm. It sucks some color, some character out of the game. I mean, I don't want to sound like a, you know, immature 12-year-old, but I think baseball fans can relate. Who didn't used to love watching Whitey Herzog go out there and just get in an umpire's face, or throw his cap, or, you know, Sparky Anderson kick dirt on an umpire, mm-hmm. Lou Piniella rip a base out of its mooring. Whereas now everybody's so nice and the managers are homogenous and they're basically there, as we've talked about, in large part to convey the organization's message to the public in a very nice and respectful manner. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, remember the Tommy Lasorda blowups, you know, somebody asking about Dave Kingman hitting 3 home runs and he went off on about 65 F-bombs in the next 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, can you imagine a manager today doing that on when it's all on TV? You can't. So yeah, there's a lot of homogenous. That's it with managers. And I don't know if we're going to get out of that spin or not. I mean, everything's cyclical. I think maybe eventually we will, but mm-hmm. maybe not in the near future.
Yeah. I can't remember the last time I saw a manager turn his hat backwards.
Oh,
I mean, we used to see it all the time, and now I can't remember. I cannot, as we're talking here, trying to think back to the last time the manager. I did go to a Philadelphia bookstore, and they had a shoebox full of baseball cards, all of them former Phillies or one-time Phillies, mm-hmm. and I did pull out a Lee Elia card from managing the Phillies, and I gave that to Oliver Marmol. I was like, you know, there you go. Yeah, he knew. We'd talked about it. Talked about and listened to the tape and of him going off at Wrigley Field. It's really interesting. I mean, the other part of that, if you're talking about a game that is global, you're talking about a game that has a very Latin influence with a lot of Latin players. Yeah. You spend a chapter in the book talking about Dusty Baker and Cito Gaston and Dave Roberts and the lack of African-American black managers in the game and the concern there, you know, within a statement that says managers become homogenized when the game isn't and has a lot of diversity, but they don't see it reflected in the managers. That's a concern.
It is. I mean, you know, I think there's no doubt. And part of the concern is you know, the African-American representation among players is down to what? I think it's 4% this year.
Yeah, it's hovers there between what, 4 and 6? I think it was 6 yeah. and a half, 7. You know, the Cardinals have 3 starters in their lineup.
Wow. Well, so the point is, as the African-American representation continues to shrink, and it's the lowest it's been, you know, in decades, or maybe ever, but what happens is then we're talking about the next wave of managers that get hired and the ex-players, guys that played recently. Yeah. And with hardly any African-American players in the game, that's just going to shrink even more the pool of African-American managers. So, you know, I think, you know, right now we've got guys like Davey Martinez in Washington and Alex Cora in Boston and, you know, Ali in St. Louis. We've got some Latin representation. And that it might be a case where that over the next several years continues to remain greater than African-American managing representation.
Especially like with Molina, Pujols, that group, if they yep, manage yep. as well, that adds to it. I want to close here, and I've enjoyed this conversation. I fear that I've kept you too long talking, but we can go Got on it. And on about baseball. I want to close here because I think like the arc of your book is really captured by two things that happened in very seminal October moments. And that is, of course, 2003 with Grady Little and Pedro Martinez, and then 2020 with Blake Snell, Kevin Cash, you know, one in a CS, the other in a World Series, and then the reactions to both. How similar do you see those events, and how on opposite sides of the coin, and how do you think baseball's reacted differently in those times, and that shows the evolution of the modern day manager?
Yeah. Well, I think, as I called it in the book, the Grady Little leaving Pedro Martinez in the game, that to me, that was like the last managerial gut decision that was ever allowed or will be allowed in the game. I mean, that was such a crushing loss to the Red Sox that, you know, obviously they fired Grady and hired Terry Francona, and, you know, talking with Theo Epstein, he said the way that all came together, he said, we had invested as an organization so much into that 2003 team. And I think it was an awakening. Theo obviously already believed in analytics anyway, and he was on his way toward constructing an analytics, well on his way toward constructing a big analytics system in Boston. But I think that reinforced to him, we as an organization, so many people have put so much into this, we can't risk letting our season come down to one man's decision. Mm. And then I think that's why I say from then on, you know, Boston kicked up its analytics department. I think other teams learned from that as well and said, same thing, you know, we're not going to get into that situation. So I think that's the key point of the Grady Little decision. And Kevin Cash, you know, it's funny because when that happened, there were a lot of people. I know I was you probably too. I think we were both in the press box in Texas that day, right?
We were. Yeah. We were both up there.
And I don't know about your reaction, but mine was kind of that old school guy. When Kevin Cash went to get Blake Snell, I mean, I knew the way Tampa Bay operated. I knew the way they did things. But in the moment, I still couldn't. I was like, this kid is pitching the game of his life. It's like showing no signs of, you got to let him go. He didn't. And then obviously things unraveled. But what I found interesting is the reaction after that game, it wasn't a bunch of people like us. It wasn't universal 100%. Like Kevin Cash screwed that up. He had his defenders. By then, analytics had taken hold, not just in the game, but it had taken hold among fans. You know, even there were some fans out there that were like, hey, third time through the lineup.
Oh, yeah.
Let the guy go through. He did the right thing.
Oh, Mookie Betts. You don't let Mookie Betts get another look at that guy.
Right.
Even though he'd look silly in previous at-bats. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And Mookie himself said, I breathe a sigh of relief in the on-deck circle. I was like, thank God they're taking this guy out.
I love that quote that you got. Yeah. No, there was definitely an element of that. And one of the things that in real time while I'm thinking there, I'm like, well, if you never let him try, then you'll never know. And that is the safest choice of all, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Absolutely. Well, he can't do this. Well, you've never given him a chance to do it. Right. Because he can't do it. Well, you never know. And gosh, that moment was great. I mean, it was great in the sense of the conversation it kicks up, an example of it. And now you look at, Grady Little makes that choice and he's not manager for a month afterwards. Kevin Cash makes that choice. He's still manager 5 years. So you want to know where managing is this. You look back to exactly what we talked about, job security and the length of it and also success. I mean, Kevin Cash is an exceptional, strong manager, you know, but he knows that he made that choice with the full backing of the collaboration. They didn't slip a lineup under his door, but they shaped it as a group.
Right. Exactly right.
That is Scott Miller, author of the new book, Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and Always Will. Scott, you're one of my favorite storytellers as far as baseball writers go. You're a longtime baseball writer, esteemed baseball writer, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I love hearing your stories. I've learned a lot from reading you through the years, and this book is no different. I learned a lot just about kind of – I mean, there's just some really unguarded comments from Dusty Baker, from Terry Francona that I really appreciated in this book. So congratulations, and thank you so much.
Derek, thank you. I loved our conversation. As I said, you know, every time I run into you in the press box, anywhere, St. Louis, San Diego, World Series, All-Star Game, it's always a pleasure. It's always a great day. And thanks for having me. And really, really, really cannot tell you how much I appreciate your kind words on the book.
Thanks. I look forward to seeing you soon, Scott.
Likewise, buddy. Take care. You're working tonight, I assume, right?
I am at the ballpark working tonight, yes. And
that's right here against those Tigers.
I'm looking forward to it. Tarek Skubal pitching.
Oh, yeah. We'll make sure to turn that one on TV out here.
Special thanks to Scott Miller, who's just one of the best baseball storytellers and baseball writers around. I have read him and known him for years and just enjoy his approach with telling baseball stories from inside perspectives, and his new book Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and Always Will is no different. There's just so much great insight, and he clearly has such trust of his sources that they share such things with him that will give you a new perspective on that vantage point from the dugout as it looks up at a completely different game from the front office and baseball operations. The change has been seismic, and it is only intensifying and accelerating in the game of baseball. You can find Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter and Always Will, at Amazon or wherever you get your books, or try an independent bookstore. Left Bank Books or the new Leviathan Bookstore on South Grand in my neighborhood here in St. Louis. If they don't have it, they can order it. So visit an independent bookstore and ask them to get Skipper by Scott Miller. This has been the best podcast in baseball, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. It's available on Spotify, iTunes, all of that stuff. It's brought to you weekly by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Sponsorships like that are made possible by subscriptions like yours. Or, if you don't subscribe, at least rate and review. Good, bad, indifferent, 3-star, 2.5-star. There on iTunes, at least gives us direction and lets us know what listeners think about the best podcast in baseball. You can find it as well with all of the Constant Cardinals covered at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. That's where my colleagues Daniel Guerrero and sports columnist Lynn Worthy and Benjamin Hockman bring you all of the coverage of the Cardinals during this winning stretch that they're on that is causing them to rethink the reset. I'm sure we'll be talking about that next week on a brand new episode of the Best Podcast in Baseball, which is brought to you weekly by STLtoday.com. For Scott Miller, author of Skipper, Why Baseball's Managers Matter and Always Will, and thanks to him for this long conversation, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. This has been the Best Podcast in Baseball. Talk to you soon.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.